Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thanks for downloading, subscribing, rating. We love it and we really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be talking about colour and how we perceive. You know, this is one of my favourite subjects. We're going to be talking about how we recreate our colourful world in the brain. And specifically, we're going to ask about this new colour called OLO that has been invented in labs in University of California and in University of Washington, where they've basically invented a colour that only five people have seen, called OLO. We'll get to that in a bit. But you may have heard that I am travelling up and down the country trying to give people the skills to use AI in their role, in their personal work, or in their business. And it's called Get Started with AI. I have an AI bootcamp happening in Cork on the 14th of May. We would love to see you there. More information at getstartedai.com. It's part of a tech fest down as part of the Technology Industry Alliance in Cork. Right. Coming up, it's the look back at the week's science news. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us science@newstalk.com and comment on any of these stories. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Jessamine Fairfield of the University of Galway join us. Shane, our first story has to do with trees.
It does. Have a guess. How many trees do you think there are on planet Earth?
It's one of those Google interviews, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Which are
pointless. I don't know. I don't want the job.
Great. Yeah, congratulations. You've got it. Yeah, so it's 1.5 trillion. I'm not sure how...
All the trees? Is that all?
That's the estimate. Yeah, 1.5 trillion. It's a lot of trees.
You think?
Yeah. Most of them are in Roscommon, of course. But this is actually a story from ESA, the European Space Agency, that are launching a new satellite into space that looks somewhat like a brolly. And it has a massive radar on it, and it's going to be able to map the Earth's trees and for the first time give it an accurate sense as to how much carbon is stored in every tree on the planet Earth, or all trees on the planet Earth, which is absolutely incredible. So they're looking at kind of mapping every tree. They're going to start in the Amazon and go from there.
But don't trees like fall down? Like it's going to be an estimate, right?
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. And trees
but
grow
pretty good
as well.
One.
Yeah, it'll be pretty good because what they have at the moment is just satellite images. And of course, they get obscured by clouds and you can only see the canopy of the forest. So you're not able to kind of penetrate in and know what lies beneath.
Right.
And that's what's different here. So they're using something called P-radar. And it has a longer wavelength associated with it. So it's able to penetrate below the canopy and see deeper into the forest below.
Oh, wow. So it could like different layers through by... How does it do that?
Yeah. So basically, because of the nature of the wavelength of this light, it's able to go further. It's why we radio waves, for example, are long wavelength. They're able to get around corners and go through things compared to like shortwave wavelengths, like your mobile phone, for example.
I don't understand that now.
No, it's interesting. That's why like radio waves tend to be about meters long, so they can go around most objects. So you can get a signal from News Talk anywhere in the country, except perhaps behind something huge like a mountain.
Right. Is the number of trees and how much they weigh, is this something that we need to know? Why do we need to know?
Because we need to know how much storage capacity there is in the Earth for carbon. And what happens then if we start to lose, instead of saying we've lost X percentage of trees on the Earth, we can start to say we've lost this amount of carbon storage capacity. So trees, of course, take in carbon dioxide and they turn that into the structure of the tree itself, and they store carbon and that's extracted from the atmosphere. I read in my physics newspaper yesterday, I get a lot of laughs at home for having a physics newspaper. Physicists
quite
in America
rightly,
are working really hard to figure out ways to take carbon out of the atmosphere. And as I was saying to Jessamine before the show, I smiled to myself, isn't it amazing? Because nature's already figured this out. It's called a plant, right? So we just need more of those and fewer of the old carbon emitters. Yeah, absolutely.
The reason I'm asking is we already know that these are important for storage and that we should be preserving them, although we don't see a huge amount of that in certain countries, unfortunately. But I suppose being able to quantify it is important.
Yeah, it's a massively important resource. So we need to know as much about this resource as is humanly possible. So we need detail, basically.
Very good. All right, our second story. I've got to be honest, I thought it'd be more interesting, that story.
Oh, sorry, Jonathan. Weighing the words.
I'm just being blunt.
They're going to have answers in 6 months, so I'll come back to you.
Why do they want to weigh it? Why do they want to weigh a tree?
Because that's like the carbon is stored in the tree. Right, so the heavier the tree, the more carbon is in it. So therefore, the bigger the carbon sink it is.
Okay. Our second story is very interesting, and it has to do with burns.
That's right. So this is a new research that's kind of exploring one of those classic trade-offs, right? Like, do you want to be fast at like sprinting or marathoning? You know, do you want to be good at eating food or eating more food? Sometimes evolution prefers one thing and sometimes it prefers the other. And this new research has come out of the Westminster Hospital in London. Basically, they've been looking at different types of genes that we have in our bodies to help us heal from like smaller, more minor burns versus big, large scale, very severe burns. And what they think they found is that actually the genes that help keep us safe from infection on smaller burns might make it more likely that we'll have complications and trouble from larger burns.
Hang on a second. Are you saying there are specific genes that are different for recovering from different severities of burns?
Yeah, so this is...
I told you this is interesting. I said this would be more interesting than your story, Shane.
Why did you give me the tree story then?
Okay, well, what's cool is the way that they did this study, right? So basically, what they did initially is they just analyzed a bunch of samples of basically like burnt and unburnt skin from humans and rats. Oh. They analyzed which genes were expressed. So this means like what kind of proteins have been made within the tissue that's coming from different genetic material. They identified a selection of genes, and then they basically compared genetic data of chimps and humans to try to see, are any of these genes preferentially expressed in humans? They found these 10 genes, which were strongly selected for, that had to do with things like pain sensation, formation of scar tissue, inflammation, and then also wound closure. So for like small scale burns, right, that's important and helpful. But what's interesting is that specifically inflammation and also the creation of scar tissue can actually cause a lot of problems in terms of recovery from larger scale burns. Mm-hmm.
Because we don't want, if we have a larger scale burn, we don't actually want scar tissue forming because you have no mobility. If it's covering a large part of the moving parts of your body, then I know this because I recently had scabs all over my knees because I was wing foiling really badly and I didn't know what I was doing because it was very painful.
So we don't want wing foiling.
Wing foiling. Yes, I'm cool. Let's move on.
What is wing foiling?
No, let's not.
Were you wing foiling through like a circle of flame? Because if so, then it's relevant to this.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, then we'll move on. But the thing that's interesting, right, is like historically, like in our distant evolutionary past, obviously using fire has been very important to the development of people, the development of tools that we use, like cooking stuff, making things, now electricity. But also, in the distant past, if we got very severe burns, like we probably weren't going to do so well. Whereas if you could recover from very smaller scale burns, like that would be very helpful, right? In terms of being able to be a fire user, but not like...
End up dying as a result. Exactly. So you're saying that we evolved these genes to focus to do better with minor burns because when we had more severe burns, we typically died. So it wasn't
that
useful.
That is the theory. Now, the one...
Sounds like a theory.
The caveat that I want to give on this, right, is it definitely is a theory. I don't think that the causality here has necessarily been determined. And actually, like this study, it's from a poster from a conference. So it's not like peer reviewed in a rigorous way yet. And I think that more research is definitely needed in this area. But it is a really interesting comparison of a bunch of genetic data and just thinking about, you know, how evolving to be good at one thing might mean that you're less good at something that actually is quite relevant now.
Yeah, very good. Medicine. Our third story, Shane, has to do with fluoride.
Yeah, and this really is a story about causation, right? So fluoride is something that's in our water and it's there to help our...
It's added to our water.
Yeah, it's added to our water in tiny amounts. And it's not added as actual fluoride. It's added as an acid, hydrofluorosilic acid, 0.7 parts per million. So tiny, tiny amounts are added to our water.
Like a salt bay... amount.
Exactly. A sousson of fluoride is added to help your teeth to adsorb calcium. So the fluoride embeds into the tooth and then it attracts calcium from food, and that helps protect your enamel. The enamel in turn helps to stop tooth decay. So really important, and has been there for quite a long time. In 2011, in their infinite wisdom, the people that run the city of Calgary in Canada decided to take the fluoride out of the water. Mm-hmm. And what this study is about is looking at children's teeth over that time. And they looked at a whopping 2,649 mouths. They got dental hygienists to come in and look at the dental health of second graders. So I think they're 7-year-olds. Jessamine will correct me if I'm wrong. And they compared them with the nearby city of Edmonton, which does fluorinate the water. And they found that in the city that doesn't fluorinate the water, 65% of the children showed signs of dental decay, right? So it's pretty bad. And in Edmonton, it was significantly lower, 55%. Now, they don't sound like a whopping difference, but it is statistically different. And they also found that the amount of health insurance claims that were going in related to dental were much, much higher. And the amount of children that unfortunately had to be given a general anaesthetic to deal with severe dental decay, that was twice as high.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just from a teeny tiny...
Yeah, tiny
smidgen, a whisper.
Yeah, and like...
fluoride.
Yeah, and like the worry, of course, here is that like it's one of these classic things that people jump on, right? There's a worry initially about staining. There was claims of bone cancer being linked to fluoride. But then when all those things were debunked, people went down the usual route of it violates the freedom that you have to choose what you put into your water. But I always say is, like, you put chlorine in your water to take out the bacteria. So why do you draw the line at the fluoride? But it's
unless you're drinking straight from the sky.
Yeah, really, absolutely. And it was associated with lower IQ. And of course, this is all in the context of Robert F. Kennedy in the US now, who's suggesting...
big anti-fluoride.
Yeah, suggesting to the CDC that they stop recommending fluoride in water. Yeah.
Big fluoride were actually on to me. They're going to send their check to you.
Thanks so much.
Shane,
yes,
in the post.
Absolutely.
Jess, our final story has to do with sleep.
That's right. It's an amazing new study that's come out that says that sleep is actually good. It helps. So
you heard it here.
You heard it here first.
I was like, wait, what?
Groundbreaking. No, I think what's interesting about this study is actually like how small an additional amount of sleep can have such a large effect. Right. Because I think we all know, you know, more sleep is good. Most of us don't get enough sleep. But this new study coming out of the University of Cambridge, they basically looked at over 3,000 adolescents. It's the largest study of its kind, looking at longitudinal sleep information. And they looked at just, you know, over a long period of time, when did they go to bed? When did they get up? And then how did they perform on things like reading, vocabulary and problem solving tests? Maybe unsurprisingly, the students that went to bed earliest and got the most sleep did the best on those things. But like the magnitude of difference between the kind of worst performing and best performing group was only about an extra 15 minutes a night. And I would have thought that's not a huge difference, right? Like this is 13 to 18 year olds. Now, on average, like the amount of sleep that this group is told to get is between 8 and 10 hours. Like, mm-hmm. You know, people who are teenagers need a lot of sleep. None of the groups were getting that amount of sleep.
Of
they were all getting under 8 hours. But yeah, just going up by 15 minutes a night put students into like the best performing group in terms of these like cognitive tasks. And I'm a little bit blown away by that because, again, I just wouldn't have thought that that was a large enough issue. What's interesting, too, I think, in this study, they talk about like...
Did they talk about a perfect amount of to make sure you're in that high cognitive group, the perfect amount of sleep, like the minimum you should aim for if you want to perform? Because I have a teenager and I want him to be perfect.
Okay, that
yeah,
sounds very
help.
Healthy. Yeah. Well, I mean, they say 8 to 10 hours, right? But what I think is interesting about this and other studies, too, is we know that for teenagers, when they get that sleep makes a difference, right? When you go through puberty, it actually, one of the many things that changes is you have a shift in your circadian clock that makes it harder to go to sleep early. Mm. And so, like, the fact that in some places, school for teenagers can start, you know, sometimes it starts at 9 a.m. In the U.S., most places it starts at 8 a.m. Like, teenagers do not do super well with that. There have been a lot of studies showing that actually their academic performance is much better if they're allowed to get a later start to the day. And yet we still are kind of just like, I go to work, you go to class. That's fine. And it's not even just academic performance. It's also like mood. It's like fewer car crashes with teenage drivers. Like, this is definitely something that we know and should be acting on a little bit more, in my opinion.
Very interesting. Thank you so much, Jessamine. It's been great having you both in the studio. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, from the University of Galway, Dr. Jessamine Fairfield. Now, researchers in UC Berkeley, California, and the University of Washington claim that they have discovered and allowed us to see a color never previously possible to be seen called OLO. And is your OLO the same as my OLO? Well, there's only one way to find out, and that is to speak to Anya Hurlburt, who's a professor of visual neuroscience at the University of Newcastle upon Tyne. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Anya. I always like to start off with a bit of basic biology and try to understand the physics before we go on and talk a little bit about the more complicated stuff. So would you mind just explaining to us how we see colour and then maybe a little bit about how that differs in different animals, for example, the mantis shrimp?
Oh, gosh. Thank you, Jonathan. I guess this is a sort of 14-hour interview. In people, it starts with having three different types of light sensors in the eye, and that's essential. There have to be three different types that respond to different regions of the visible spectrums. And we sort of call those blue, green, and red, or short, middle, and long wavelength types of light sensors. But then after those sensors get the light coming in, that those signals are sent up to the brain where much more processing takes place before we even can perceive or conceive of a color that we might call magenta or cyan or violet or chartreuse. And what makes us different from other animals is that other animals might have different types of light sensors. So the mantis shrimp, for example, has 12 different types of light sensors. So it can selectively pick out different regions of the spectrum that we cannot differentiate from each other. But the mantis shrimp brain is not as big as ours, so unclear that it does as much with all those signals as we do with our fewer lot of three.
I guess one of the main points about how we perceive color is something we've covered many times in this program, is that we perceive with our brain, not with our sensor organs, like our ears or our eyes or our nose, for example. And so we build a picture of what color we're seeing in the brain. That said, though, there are objects out there that appear to us in different colors. Why does something appear red and why does something appear blue?
Well, because what we're doing when we're conceiving of color, constructing colors from the light signals that come to our eyes, is trying to extract something about the physical properties of that thing reflecting the light. So we're not just trying to conceive of willy-nilly some arbitrary color from the light signals that hit the eye. We're going about it in a way that is trying to extract crucial, meaningful information. So we see apples as red because they tend to reflect more light in the long wavelength part of the spectrum. And when we see it as red, we're interpreting the way the object is reflecting light. So the red that we see does correspond to the physical properties of the object,
right?
Which makes sense because we want to use color to guide our behavior. And we would like our the color perception that we create in our brains to correspond to something meaningful about the object, like how ripe it is or how fresh it is.
Right. So we probably evolved this ability to sense color to be able to help us navigate the world evolutionarily, to be able to see, as you say, whether something's fresh or not, or whether something's a certain type of plant. Am I right in saying that the sort of the gut explanation of the very basic explanation is that light comes from a light source, and it hits a surface, and depending on the atomic structure or the physical structure of that surface, it will absorb a certain amount of that light energy, and it will reflect a certain amount. And the amount it reflects equates to a certain a wavelength of light that we then, our brains then go, oh, that wave of light, I'm going to turn that into red because it's useful to understand this as red.
Yes, roughly speaking, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, light strikes the surface reflects light back to the eyes, but having absorbed some of it, the spectrum it reflects to the eyes is not the same as what hit it.
Right.
And there's differences between objects in terms of which bits of the spectrum are reflected back to the eye are what we interpret as color.
Excellent. And we can only see, obviously, the visual spectrum just stops short of ultraviolet and infrared. But within that spectrum, can we see all of the colors? Can we differentiate between all of the colors in between those spectrum, given that we have these three different color cones that we can see red, blue, green, Richard W. York gave battle in vain?
Well, we're limited because those three cone types, they're called cones, have sensitivities to light that are overlapping with each other. So there's only so much differentiation they can do when any light spectrum hits them, so that the sort of reddish, red sensitive cone, as it were, overlaps a lot with the green sensitive cone. So they can't, there's some wavelengths of light they can't actually differentiate well between.
So then how do we come up with new colors that previously weren't able to make? Because, you know, as a kid and as a father, when you look at paint, you just mix it together. And it feels like you can make any color in the world. But that's obviously technically not true if scientists claim to have created a new visible color. And then remember, actually, maybe about 10 years ago or 20 years ago, it might have been seeing the first sort of reflective t-shirt in a, you know, in these bright yellow and green and pink, this sort of neon type t-shirt, which we were never able to make before. How do we make new colors?
Well, so you've just hit on sort of two ways. So one is to make new physical substances that reflect light in different ways. And, you know, neon type paints, you know, are different because they have properties that actually don't just absorb some of the wavelength and then reflect some back. They actually sort of create new light by fluorescing or phosphorescing, for example. Mm. And butterfly wings create colors that are iridescent, and they create this in different ways because they have these fascinating nanostructures inside their wings that make them reflect light of different wavelengths at different angles. Mm. Their color changes depending on which angle you're looking at. And so they're physical ways to create different colors. But then there are also biological ways, which are effectively to sort of put new sensors into someone's eyes or make the sensors that are there, stimulate the sensors that are there in a way that's never been done before. And that's what this new study has done. And that's what's so exciting about it, is that it hasn't created a new physical substance. It's just used one wavelength of light, but it targeted it on the different light sensors in the eye in very specific ways, which is pretty much impossible to do, actually has been impossible to do up until now, and would never be done with any natural object or any physical paints or pigment or butterfly wing.
Huh. And so if I mean, presumably if I look at this on the screen, it's not going to work. I have to see it in real life, do I?
Yeah, you couldn't look at it on a screen.
Because, yeah, I was looking at this color on the screen. I was going, I don't understand how this is in any way. It just looks like teal. But if I saw it in real life, I would see something completely different, would I?
I think you'd be completely wowed. First of all, you'd have to fly to California and undergo several weeks of extensive experimentation so that the individual cone types at different locations in a small square of your retina could be classified in terms of their different sensitivity. Hmm. So they had to be classified as blue, green, or red, short, middle, or long. And then you'd have to undergo this very specific laser light stimulation in a setup that actually tracks the micro movements of your eyes as they naturally drift when you look at something.
Huh. That sounds like a bit of a faff now, in fairness.
But it would be so exciting to see, because it is something that only five people in the world have seen thus far, and tremendously exciting to see a color that is sort of beyond human conception, completely outside the range of natural colors that we see. And the closest thing to it is a sort of very deep, vivid teal, according to the people who've seen it.
Now you've made it sound very exciting indeed, because up until now, I didn't really get it, because I'd been reading about these other scientists and researchers who created different colored paints. And then, of course, the blackest of all blacks, that that you can create the blackest black that looks like there's literally no information. Nothing gets reflected black. And it just looks like a hole in your vision.
It's like a hole in your vision, exactly, because no light is coming from it. But you can, it's quite fun to go into a room that is completely black. It's very, very difficult. But the dining in the dark experience does that. And it's a complete black void. It's almost, again, impossible to imagine, but it is something that everybody could experience just by removing all light stimuli from their field of vision. Whereas to see this new color is a much more rarefied experience. And to generate it is hugely technically challenging, but I mean, absolutely full marks to that team for doing this.
We spoke to a biohacker a number of years back who claimed to have been able to create eye drops that allowed him to see at much a wider wavelength, specifically in ultraviolet, to be able to see, or infrared, to be able to see in the dark. Is that something you've come across? Is that theoretically possible to modify our vision to be able to see in the dark or see in ultraviolet?
Good question. I would guess that you could create a device that is able to sense ultraviolet or infrared. And of course, bees can see in ultraviolet, and some animals might have infrared vision, and then converts that energy into a visible wavelength. And then that visible wavelength stimulates the sensor. So in that sense, you are seeing what the signal is. I mean, that's done in the auditory domain with those lovely devices that enable you to hear, so to speak, bat shrieks, which are outside of our normal hearing range, just by down converting them into our frequency range. Take the device out when bats are flying around and you can hear them squeaking away, but it hasn't changed your sensitivity. I mean, that's the kind of key thing.
Right, right. So I just want to finally ask about the dress, because it's a question I'm sure you're asked about over and over again. But the famous image from 2015, this image of a dress that for some people looked black and gold, for others it looked blue and white, was it?
Black and white and gold.
White and gold,
yeah. Blue and black, some people, black, said white and gold, others. Yeah.
Have we come to a consensus on why some people see something completely different to other people? Have we figured that out yet definitively?
Yeah, it's we have got a pretty good handle on it. So it goes back to that point about color being a thing we want to be able to make use of. We want it to be behaviorally meaningful to it. And so we're constantly trying to effectively correct for changes in the light shining on objects. Because when the light changes, shining on an object changes, and the light reflected from the object changes. So we have to kind of account for that variation, and that's called color constancy. And we're really good at seeing apples as red in the kitchen, outside under moonlight, in daylight, under tungsten light, and we're constantly correcting for that effect of the change in illumination. So what's happening with the dress, we've sort of worked out, is that people are correcting for different light sources. So people who see it as black and blue are correcting effectively for a sort of bright yellow light source. And people who see it as white and gold are correcting for a dim blue light source. But they're doing it completely unconsciously.
And the brain is just imagining in that environment that there's a certain type of light source in that room that you can't see. And it's just assuming, as you say, that it's this sort of a lighting in the room, and therefore it's painting the color. And I think that's really interesting, because if you look at lots of different optical illusions, they show us that actually, depending on the light, colors can seem all sorts of different things, but it's really a very subjective experience that's created in our brain. It's a really fascinating subject, and thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about it. I just love talking about perception, so thank you so much. Anya Hurlburt is Professor of Visual Neuroscience at the University of Newcastle upon Tyne. Anya, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jonathan.
The mantis shrimp, by the way, if you are interested in the weirdness of animals, which I always am, the mantis shrimp is a fantastic animal for your child to do for an animal project next year, if that's coming up, right? Because the projects can be a lot. The mantis shrimp is a fantastic animal to learn about. Last week, we were talking to Glyn Tallon, who's an embalmer, about what he does in his work and how he manages to get through, because it can be a very difficult thing at times when you're dealing with a traumatic death, particularly if there's been an accident or a severe trauma. Tracy says, I was listening to Glyn speaking about the care he takes with family's loved ones. I lost my lovely husband in November of 2021, and he looked so peaceful, like he was asleep after the embalming care given to him. We as a family were so relieved when we saw him and so appreciative of the care taken of him. I wondered if Glyn could recommend what course he took to become an embalmer, please. Tracy, we'll ask Glyn that, absolutely, and we'll contact you directly. I'm really sorry to hear about the loss of your husband. And it was lovely to hear Glyn talk about his work and the care and devotion he has to trying to honour those who have died. So thanks so much for your comment, Tracy. He was a really exceptional guest. Danielle said, I actually didn't really know anything about embalming, so hearing about that injection was fascinating. Can't say I would ever do that job, though. Another says, I don't know why I hear embalming. I think of Egyptian mummies, but were they embalmed too, yeah? Or does mummification differ exactly? Or how does mummification differ exactly? Well, how long have we got? The Egyptians, I haven't got long, says my producer, with her eyes. The Egyptians were amazing. They would make this tiny incision at the side of your body, and then they just like take out all of your organs, all the wet bits. They're just a tiny little hole. And for a long time, scientists, you know, looking at these and archaeologists were like, how on earth did they manage to embalm these bodies so well? But they did tiny little incisions. It was a real art. And it was only performed by a very restricted group of people who were absolute masters and knew anatomy really well. They preserved the heart because they believed that's where the soul of someone was, but they didn't preserve the nose. And actually, on this program a few years back, I was hearing about this tool that they had found in the embalmer's kit, and they couldn't figure out what it was, you know, that they were preparing the body for the mummy, and they understood what most of the tools were, but there was this tiny little whisk-looking thing. And what they found was to get rid of the brain, they would put the body standing up, and then would put this whisker thing up the nose, and they just liquefy the brain, and it would just come out like a milkshake out the nose. And that's how they would mummify these bodies, and they would last forever. Ingenious, when you think about it. But yeah, pretty gross. There you go. A little bit of a factoid for you to share at the pub or at your next mass. That's it for this episode. Thanks to Marais O'Sullivan, Rory Galvin and Hugo De Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.